is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Last week, I told you about Robert Silvera, a.k.a. Sidetrack, a.k.a. the Boxcar Killer, and his years-long series of murders. Sidetrack traveled at will, with no record of his movements, and his pool of victims were the unhoused, the drifters, and the fellow railhoppers he encountered. People on the fringe, the kind who wouldn't be missed. This week, the end of the murders, the arrest, and many confessions of Robert Silvera, as well as the California police detective who moonlighted as Elvis, a quirk which endeared him to the killer, and also led to this cop writing the actual book on the case. This is Freedom Part 2. Retired Spokane Police Detective Bob Granadetti had compiled perhaps the largest database of information about the FTRA, the Freight Train Riders of America, and linked them to food stamp fraud, trafficking, hundreds of thefts and assaults, and murders. Granadetti discovered the FTRA's existence after recording 10 unsolved deaths between 1990 and 1992 on the High Line between Seattle and Minneapolis. Bodies found near the tracks along the route from Cheney, Washington to Sandpoint, Idaho. This was the same period Granadetti noticed a significant presence of FTRA members rolling through Spokane. The element that stood out in these reports was the state in which the bodies were discovered, with their shirts or coats pulled up over their heads and their pants pulled down, later learned to be a trademark of FTRA killings, though not a trademark of Silvera's murders.
So multiple people were doing that and leaving them that way?
Yeah, there were a ton found that way. There was a guy named Juan Lara, I believe, who was killed by several men. And he was one of the ones that was found, I think, in Texas. People who were thrown off trains, people who were put on the tracks and run over by trains.
It seems like, I mean, it's definitely a gang, but it seems hard to have a gang that sprawls that wide, you know?
Oh, it's so loosely associated that, and yeah, and it was so early in having internet, having that sort of connectivity,
wow,
that it was impossible to track. Most law enforcement agencies had no idea that these people were like rolling through their towns,
wow,
every day.
Can you just imagine though, like spreading, okay, we're going to, when we kill people, this is what we're going to do, but without internet and phone, like, wow.
Oh, well, we were laughing at, we have this inside joke of honking on a bobo, which is from an old Aerosmith video or interview.
An album, I think, is called Honkin' on Bobo.
Yeah, and that's what it's called for Steven Tyler when he's doing his harmonica. And then we adopted that for other things. And we'll, like, if having a joint, or like, you honking on that bobo? And then I sent him a meme because it was someone Snapchatting. And they're like, honking on this bobo at this lake. And I feel like the silliest goose. And I'm like, isn't that funny that
it spreads like
that? Like no connection, and someone hears it and correlates
it
to the same thing.
Well, it is kind of a silly saying, and I feel like you could easily.
Yeah. I was like, well, that's how
the same thing.
That's how the Marilyn Manson rib rumor
spread
across the country in middle school.
I saw a TikTok video about, like, how is it that we're pre-internet and that spread?
And everyone of that age knows
Or
that.
Like the Tootsie Pop Star.
Yes.
Where you get the free one. Because I kid you not, Dairy Queen gave me a free one time when I brought them my wrapper. And it must have just been the worker.
Yeah.
Like, thought it was cute.
Yeah.
And had a Tootsie Pop in his pocket?
No. Like, I brought one up from the aisle and I'm like, here, I have my wrapper. Like, I just boldly acted as if, and he was like, all right.
One free lollipop, please.
It probably cost him like 13 cents of his paycheck. But I was like, oh, cool. It works.
So funny.
Anyway, for those that don't know, the wrapper of the Tootsie Pop, some of them had a Native American shooting an arrow at a star. And there was this shared belief amongst our childhood that if you sent those in, you would get a free Tootsie Pop.
In October of 1995, Paul Wayne Matthews, who had the nickname Glassy because of his artificial eye, was the next person to suffer under Sidetrack's self-applied authority. Paul Matthews' last known address was in Austin. He was originally from Arkansas, and he'd lost contact with his family a decade earlier when he left home after his wife died. he spent his days riding freight trains and drinking alcohol. Matthews and Silvera encountered each other under a bridge in Spokane, a well-known spot where rail riders waited to catch their next train. They'd first met 6 months earlier at a mission in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Matthews told Silvera he had to go to Havre, Montana to collect his food stamps, and then he was just going to wander the rails along the High Line for a while. Silvera said he also had to go there to reestablish food stamp benefits.
So what's with going to that area? Is that like where their home address was, or is it easier to get them there, the food stamps?
Silvera had just been in Montana, Havre, Montana, a few months ago, or Whitefish, where he killed Charles Boyd. Right. And he was using his ID to establish food stamps. So he was going back to do that.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I know it's not victimless and taking the murders away from it. Anyone that wants to put up with the effort it takes to file government benefits and who wants to fill out the paperwork and talk with those people and wait in the lines, go for it. You know, like
even if you're ripping them off.
That's like, my crime is going to the DMV what to get your, more tags.
What if your thing was like the thing you loved the most was waiting in long lines? Like,
then it's a perfect crime.
I know, right?
Someone like Silvera, a rider or a transient of some sort, would probably be pretty patient because they often would just have to wait hours and hours for rides.
That's true.
Through weather, while they're hungry, all that stuff. Also, it was found later that Silvera had 28 food stamp accounts.
Whoa.
In different names all across the country.
So he wasn't hungry.
And for from each one, he was collecting $119 per.
Wow.
And then he was using that to, you know, I mean, feed his life, but also feed his drug use. He was a heroin addict and I think a crack addict and probably meth.
Yikes.
So
that'll do it.
That'll
That's
do
impressive,
it.
Though.
But it's quite a scam. That is widespread. Wow. And it was not just him. It was a lot of people, a lot of writers and other dudes he knew that did that as well. That was their job. They caught out from Spokane on the Northern Burlington Line, heading east, and hopped off the train 15 miles north of Kalispell in Whitefish, Montana, one of the towns in which the FTRA may have first formed. Paul Matthews and Robert Silvera set up camp under a train trestle that ran over a bend in the Whitefish River. The pair then went to a nearby market to buy food and jugs of Thunderbird wine. And on their walk back, Silvera felt his first urge to kill his companion. Back at the camp, Silvera and Matthews started a fire with pieces of wood from the end of a rotted telephone pole and began to drink their wine. As the alcohol coursed through them, they taunted each other into several shoving matches and a lengthy fist fight until calling it a draw and going to their respective sleeping bags.
It's just, I can picture it, but at the same time, it's like, who does that?
Yeah.
It feels at times like it was sort of a pack mentality, and there always had to be an alpha,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that seems probably right.
Which makes sense for those kind of circumstances.
Incredibly dangerous at all times.
Yes.
Well, also, you have to think they're probably individually very dangerous because you have to be when you live
right.
that kind of life. Mm-hmm. It's such like a loner, yet you form these packs, but you're still very much on your own. You're the only one that really has your own
right.
back.
Laying awake fuming at Matthews, Silvera heard a train approaching from far off. He rose, hefted the 4-foot-long section of telephone pole they'd used for fuel nearby, and walked it over to where Paul Matthews slept deeply. Silvera raised the wood hunk over his head and slammed it onto the man's head many times, finally relenting when he saw brain and chips of skull among all the blood.
That's how he's done all of them, isn't it?
Every single one
it's
has
like,
been, yeah.
They're in so a tent or something, and then he crushes their head.
And it may start in some other way with a fight or a stabbing. But it always ends
well,
with
he's building
that.
Himself up to it. Oof. Ew. That is so gnarly.
He chucked both wine bottles into the river, followed by Matthews' backpack, which he knew would soon take on air and sink. Silvera quickly dragged the body into a small ravine and covered it with Matthews' sleeping bag, then ran to the train and hopped on, ending up in Spokane, Washington. There, Silvera had a passport photo taken for a fake Idaho ID card in the name of Paul Wayne Matthews, so he could establish new welfare benefits in multiple cities. And that's what I was talking about, him going back to Havre initially. On train trestles, under bridges, scrawled across concrete pillars, and inside the boxcars he rode, you could find Silvera's tag all across the states. It comprised of the sidetrack moniker in big bold letters, and below that a set of railroad tracks, a connected spider web, and a cracked skull. It was a warning that hissed, "I am death, and you could be next." When police later searched a Havre, Montana hobo camp, their terminology, they came across a hand-drawn FTRA sign featuring Silvera's sidetrack tag, among several others, and a message across the bottom. Whoever thrashed this camp is dead meat. Unless you fix it, then we'll just make you wish you were dead. By November of 1995, Silvera moved about freely on the trains between San Francisco, El Paso, Memphis, Havre, Montana, and Little Rock, Arkansas, using the alias Roy Allen Bell. This was found on an arrest record from Vancouver, Washington, where the most recent victim, Paul Matthews, was arrested for trespassing on railroad property with Roy Allen Bell. William Pettit Jr. was a big man, 6'4", with a thick mustache, a receding hairline, and beads woven into his ponytail. He was a longtime transient who rolled with a ton of gear aside from his pack and sleeping bag, like a Coleman camping stove and a portable radio, which he hauled around on his flat-tired bicycle. Originally from Maryland, he had lost touch with his family years prior. William felt no fear when Silvera hopped into the station boxcar he was occupying in an Oregon train yard. The men were familiar with each other from staying in various missions and centers for the houseless across the states. Mistakenly expecting the train to take them to Portland, it was instead sidetracked for maintenance, landing them in Salem. It was pouring rain as it had been for a week, so they decided to hunker down for the night and hop an early train the next day. They drank beer, and after having to split the last one, an argument ensued as they always did with Silvera. He was intimidated by William Pettit's size. This is someone who could beat Silvera in a fair fight. According to Silvera, Pettit challenged him by waving his sleeping bag at him like a bullfighter with his cape. Silvera said from his position lying down, he cocked his leg back and kicked Pettit so hard in the face it killed him instantly. Yet Silvera's rage had not subsided, so he rose and continued to kick William Pettit in the ribs and head. He then picked up a 2x4 and continued the beating, quote, flattening Pettit's head beyond recognition. Silvera next waded into a nearby creek where he undressed and let his bloodied clothes float away in the current. After washing off, he dressed in a sweatshirt and jeans, returned to the boxcar, and donned Pettit's military-style jacket. He stole some of the dead man's other belongings, like his new steel-toe boots, the radio, and the Coleman stove, all balanced atop the bike with flat tires. Silvera's final touch in the boxcar was writing the word tattooed on his neck onto the wall above the body in blue marker. Freedom. William Pettit's body was discovered 2 days later, on December 3, 1995, in Millersburg, Oregon, around 20 miles south of Salem. My guess is moving that boxcar for maintenance was a low priority, hence the two-day gap in finding the crime scene. From the single crime scene photo I've seen of the Pettit murder, it looks like he was jackrolled while he was sleeping. William Pettit is on his back, wrapped in his unzipped bag, with its hood pulled over the top half of his bludgeoned head. You can see his awesome mustache and lower jaw jutting out from the hood. Below that are some of the beads he wore in his hair. His left hand is curled on his chest, and his right is lax, resting at his waist. To me, this was an ambush killing. William Pettit was identified after autopsy by his fingerprints, which were on record from an arrest.
So do you think he was lying about how he was killed?
I think so.
Yeah,
he often did.
Unlikely.
That was a theme. I got a lot of this material from the book written on the case by one of the detectives, Murder on the Rails. And from what I understand, Silvera had some input on the book. And so everything is a little skewed.
I see.
Yeah. He kind of puts in, oh, this guy was a pedophile. This guy tried to make a sexual move on
course,
me. This guy, whatever.
Explain his actions.
Yep, every time. Because the murder occurred within Salem, the investigation was assigned to police detective Mike Quakenbush. Detective Quakenbush sent a teletype to law enforcement agencies around the country to establish Pettit's travel history and to see if there were similar homicides in their areas. Two of the many responses he received were from Salt Lake City Detective Guy Yoshikawa and Kansas Bureau of Investigation Special Agent Bruce Meller. Yoshikawa was the lead on the April 21, 1995 murder of James Hooter McLean, who was stabbed in the ribs and beaten to death with a 2x4 during a drunken argument with Robert Silvera. Agent Bruce Meller worked out of KBI headquarters in Topeka and investigated the murder of Charles Boyd, who'd been killed with a concrete block in a Kansas State park in late July 1995. Detective Yoshikawa had been the one to give Agent Meller the name and birth date of Robert Silvera, which he'd retrieved from the SLC County Jail system. That gets a good police work bell.
Yeah, imagine how hard it was to do that kind of research before our computers we have now.
Yeah, it was all by hand. Yoshikawa had to submit that to a actual person to enter it into a computer.
I imagine it was a lot more schmoozing over the phone, too, to like get what you want from people, to get them to actually go to a file room and fax you over.
For an interstate murder case?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, just that they were even willing to do that much work for people that you would think they could easily dismiss.
Yeah.
We don't know who this is. We don't know where they were.
I think it
we'll
was just a whole other skill set people had back then. Like we have people who are very good detectives now, but they maybe aren't good socially.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
The Silvera name went nowhere until 3 months later when Agent Meller returned to the case after finishing up other work. Among a list of aliases inside the case file was the name Robert Silvera. Michael Kleitz of Waldport, Oregon, had been a rail rider for 6 months. He had a tall blonde mohawk braided with strands of beads, like victim Michael Pettit, and also had an Aryan Brotherhood-style double lightning bolt tattoo on the side of his head. He looked hard, but his youthful face and slim frame belied that. He was only 24. He was new to the lifestyle, but Michael Kleitz was no stranger to the peril of the rails. 3 months earlier, in Longview, Washington, he had escaped death, surviving two stab wounds inflicted by an acquaintance who thought Michael was, quote, messing around with his girlfriend. It was in Eugene that Michael Kleitz and Robert Silvera first met on December 6, 1995, 5 days after he'd killed William Pettit. Silvera knew the three men the newish rider was talking to in the train yard, so he stopped to chat. Silvera told them he was returning to Havre, Montana, likely to collect food stamp benefits under his victim Paul Wayne Matthews' name. Kleitz asked if he could ride there with Silvera, but Silvera balked, saying he would only take him to Vancouver, Washington. They went off together to score drugs before the train they'd take to Montana arrived. Kleitz and Silvera then hopped onto the boxcar, and it had no more than started rolling through the yard when, of course, the two began to shout at each other, allegedly about Silvera ripping off the drug dealer they'd just bought from. Robert Silvera became enraged and caved in Kleitz's face with a metal pole. He tossed the metal into a body of water the train was passing by, then grabbed a hunk of wood and continued to pummel the man's face and head. After, he covered Kleitz's ruined head and stole the boots from his feet. Before getting off the train outside of Portland, Silvera stopped to write freedom on the wall. Salem Detective Quakenbush spoke to one of the men in the Eugene train yard that day talking to Michael Kleitz. That person, Bam Bam, knew Kleitz from the mission in Vancouver, Washington. At the mission in Vancouver, Quakenbush found a man who'd ridden a boxcar with Kleitz to Eugene, who said that the last time he'd seen Michael Kleitz, he was walking off in search of methamphetamine with a tall stranger who called himself Sidetrack.
That's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
That he was able to capture that much info.
It's all coming together.
With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com, and use the code RAIN for 10% off today.
It was Christmas Eve Eve of 1995 in a dumping ground slash makeshift campsite in Barstow, California, when Robert Silvera and two other writers beat 44-year-old Michael Allen Brandolino to death over the course of 3 hours. Oof. He was an easy target for them, as he was a smaller person, as well as being epileptic. The cruelty he endured is unimaginable. Michael was outnumbered and had no way to defend himself. When his attackers finally took a break from savaging him, Brandolino tried to crawl away while they drank and laughed around the fire. He was dragged back to the camp and kicked to death. The body was found 6 days later near a dry riverbed that ran beside Interstate 15, less than 900 feet north of a double set of railroad tracks. And two men, neither of which were Silvera, were convicted of the murder.
Of course. That is brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a lengthier part. I truncated a lot of the detail of that because it was really
I could imagine.
Awful.
Yeah.
Detective Quakenbush came across Choo Choo Johnson and a friend, both of them hobos, who were later to confirm key details about Silvera's appearance. And these are details from a documentary I watched called Mugshots, Robert Silvera, Third Rail Man, which is available on YouTube. Choo Choo Johnson and Bob Guitar Whitey Johnson, not related, met Silvera on a train out of Dunsmuir, California, heading north. The three hopped off in Portland, Oregon's Brooklyn train yard. Silvera, calling himself Paul Dykeman, offered to make them coffee to share. Whitey described Silvera as charming, engaging, patient, and courteous. Choo Choo took a photo of Silvera and Guitar Whitey standing together in the train yard. Silvera's gear was also captured in the picture. You can see a sledgehammer handle with a taped grip sheathed in his pack. The caption on the back of the photo, in part, reads, "He is a benign member of dreaded FTRA. Whitey said it would have been the perfect time for him and Choo Choo to be killed. 4 a.m. with nowhere to go for help, Whitey said, if he wanted to do it then, he could have. Guitar Whitey quit riding the rails after he learned of Silvera's identity and how close he'd been to death by bludgeon.
Oof. Yeah, that'd be scary.
It was the night before Silvera's 37th birthday, March 2nd, 1996. Silvera was walking in the train yard at Roseville, California, northeast of Sacramento. There he was approached by a railroad agent, Billy Metcalf, who was only 3 years from retirement. By this time, Silvera knew he was wanted by law enforcement. The officer knew he had his man when Silvera gave him the alias Paul Dykeman, which was linked to Silvera by the list of aliases sent in the teletype from Detective Quakenbush.
Embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
Think of another name, man.
And that was something I tried to find, too. I don't know where he got that ID, but it had his picture on it and everything. Metcalf said he believed there was a warrant out in that name and asked if Silvera would ride in the truck to his office. Silvera politely agreed to do so. Before getting in the vehicle, he tossed his pack in the bed, took out his 9mm handgun, kicked it under the truck to Metcalf, and said, "I will this to you." Metcalf said, "Okay," and he grabbed the gun, and he drove them to the office and had Silvera take a seat, uncuffed, while the officer made some phone calls.
That's an interesting turn of events I didn't expect.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be just a shootout, right?
Yeah.
The first call was to the Roseville Police Department, where Metcalf found there was a warrant out for Paul Dykeman / Silvera's arrest. He could be held on a probation violation while the many cases against him came together. Metcalf hung up and asked if his name was Robert Joseph Silvera. Sidetrack nodded his head and said yes. Officer Metcalf had Silvera empty his pockets, then handcuffed him. He was shortly booked at the Placer County Sheriff's Department in nearby Auburn. Quote, "His backpack, which contained some evidence of the killings in Oregon, was left behind in the evidence locker at the rail yard." Huh. And I believe it was William Pettit's ID card, the beads from his hair, some of his belongings, and also I think some of Michael Clyte's belongings.
How long did it take them to get those?
I don't know when they got them, but I imagine it was pretty quick because he was moved to that jail and then detectives started coming in from different states.
Yeah.
And so they probably cleared that up pretty quick. But I thought that was funny.
Helpful.
That they, yeah.
Josh, in what you were reading, did you feel like it wasn't kind of that arrogance of, "I'm not going to get caught and I'm above these guys, so I'll play along"? Or lack of intelligence that he didn't think that anything would come from that.
I don't think it was either of those. I think he was really worn out from life on the rails, and I think he had become tired of what he was compelled to do all the time. I think he didn't want to kill anymore.
When you're in jail, you're going to have your three meals and
some structure, a home, a permanent roof. Yeah.
Not wondering if someone's going to kill you every time you sleep. I mean, wondering about it less, I suppose.
Well, when you're that scary, you probably doesn't have to worry like someone else who's going in.
I think he was a pretty intimidating figure. There was an interview with him in prison talking about weightlifting. And he said the maximum, The maximum was 680. And he could bench press 545.
I was going to say he could lift a lot because those railroad pieces of wood that he would smash them with, those are incredibly heavy. I only know this because we went camping and needed firewood, and that's the only wood we can find. And it took like two incredibly large guys to bring one over.
Wow.
And he could hoist it no problem. That was another part of the book that I read was someone else in jail described him as scary strong. Just that he didn't really look it because he was tall and kind of lean, but he was very strong.
You just have to show that off once in the prison yard and they're going to leave you alone. I mean, and I'm guessing his reputation preceded him.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who's this guy? Oh, okay. We'll leave him alone.
Now, did he have involvement in some of these Aryan gangs that you mentioned earlier?
I think it was another loose association just to kind of say, we believe in these things also. Mm. It may have been from people being in prison and becoming associated with them. It's hard to tell if it was like real. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, because I'm just wondering, you know, it's pretty well known that there are gangs of those types in prison. So they would probably know who he was.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. By the time he got there, I'm sure they were well acquainted. And just from having the FTRA association too, I'm sure there was a lot of chatter about that. Okay. And these are a few quotes from The Guardian. Finally, Detective Quakenbush's persistence paid off. On the afternoon of Saturday, March 2nd, 1996, he got a call at home from a railroad agent working in Roseville, one of the largest rail yards in the West. "Hey," the bull said, "I have Silvera."
Wow.
At the jail, Quakenbush leaned close to a plexiglass window separating him from Silvera and asked, "When you ride the trains, what name do you use?" Silvera answered blankly, "Sidetrack." Quakenbush now realized that he had his man. To his surprise, Silvera quickly confessed to two killings in Oregon, said he was a prominent member of the FTRA Brotherhood, admitted to being a heroin user, and then gave the details of six more killings. He wanted to get it all off his chest. He was tired of the lifestyle. He said he was glad he got caught because he would have continued to kill.
That's why I wonder if he had one of those like inner monologues where it's like he desperately wanted to stop, but he just couldn't.
Yeah.
I know that he felt shame, you know, almost after almost every killing, he would cover their faces.
Or killed them while they were covered when he couldn't see them.
Yeah.
You know, like there are those people that fly into a rage and really can't think clearly. Like, I wonder if that was part of the problem.
I think he couldn't control himself. I think he did that. And I also think he allowed himself to transform into that. He wanted someone to piss him off. Like there was
egg him on and
he was camping with someone and he burnt the food purposely to start a fight.
Crazy.
Or when they had the argument about splitting the last beer, it was because he went to the store and only brought back one beer to be a dick.
So maybe he just had a need for it.
I think so. Well, I think I kind of talk about it a little bit, his youth. But in the first part, I talked about the time when his abusive father tried to make him beat up some kids with a baseball bat.
Oh, right.
Which
right.
made me think that maybe the dad also used that baseball bat to hit Silvera. And I think it just played out as an adult. He's smashing his dad to pieces.
Yeah, he's angry and it's got to go somewhere.
In an interview soon after his arrest, Silvera told Detective Quakenbush he had killed 28 people. His first murder indictment came through on March 12th in Salem, Oregon, for the murder of William Pettit. In custody, Silvera also detailed numerous random murders across the country, which I could not confirm, and I'm only going to go into one of them, the first. Having spent some time in jail for auto theft and unable to hold a steady job, at 21, Robert Silvera hit the road, hitchhiking from California to Arizona. Walking along the highway one day with his pack on his back, a mid-40s man in a black car slowed beside him, asking if he needed a ride. Silvera said he was going to Tucson, and the man said, "Hop in if you can pay for some gas." so Silvera paid him in food stamps. The man drove them a few miles down a dirt road off the highway, saying he wanted to stop and drink a beer. Their empty cans became targets after the man produced a 9mm German Luger pistol. The man went first. Silvera threw the can in the air, and the man shot several holes in it. When he handed the gun to Silvera and stood behind him, Silvera whirled around and shot him in the face. He hoisted the body and flopped it into the trunk, then drove the car into a ravine, stuffed twigs and bits of wood into the tank spout, and lit it with a road flare. Silvera scrambled a short distance away, up and out of the ravine, and watched the car burn into a smoking heap. Silvera gathered his gear, stored the gun in his pack, and walked back to the highway, where he soon caught a ride to Tucson. It was an event from which Silvera learned and made adjustments. He now knew that he needed a faster escape after a killing, that he shouldn't kill those who could be noticed as missing, and that he needed to have the upper hand at all times. Silvera later said, quote, "He went back later to the same spot in Arizona where he had set the black sedan on fire. He was surprised to see there was no evidence of any incident there. It was like it never happened. There was only sand." In research for these episodes, I could find no record of this missing, murdered man or his burnt out car.
Are you telling me I cannot trust a train hopping sociopath murderer?
It's true.
Hmm.
Well, that takes out a few of the guys I'm seeing.
Unmatch.
That was another one of the cases where Silvera said that the guy made a move on him. When he first picked him up, was like, "Hey, do you like to party?" And then when they were shooting the gun, the man stood behind him to be like, "Here's how you shoot." And Silvera said that the guy like kind of squeezed him and that's when he did it. But I don't believe any of that is true. Lieutenant William G. Palmini heard many of Silvera's confessions. He'd been the lead on the July 1995 murder of James J.C. McLean in Albany, California, who'd been bludgeoned to death after inviting Silvera into his hut to drink a beer. Detective Palmini was more than your everyday murder police. He was also Elvis. Along with his band and the Lawmen, he sang his King of Rock and Roll style tunes dressed like the man himself, in a white jumpsuit, gold medallions, and a black pompadour wig. Since at least the late 70s, he'd been teaching kids about traffic safety with songs like Designated Driver Blues, Chief Operator, One Way Ride, and the heartfelt classic Daddy Please, some of which were hits on local radio. Kids went bonkers for them, and the band's album Traffic Safety Gold received an honorary gold record from the Recording Industry of America in 1996. A handful of Elvis and the Lawmen songs are available on YouTube, and a link to those clips is in my sources. Please enjoy. Aww. Robert Silvera told Palmini that he had killed at least one person in each state he visited in his rail travels. Silvera had been through 38 states, 10 more murders than he'd admitted to Salem detectives. Palmini found it relatively easy to get Silvera to talk, as he recognized Palmini as the Elvis cop, which endeared him to Silvera, forming between them something nearing friendship. When Silvera was finally in prison, there was a photo of the two of them shaking hands after their interview, and Silvera had that up in his cell.
Maybe he just really liked Elvis.
I think so. Well, yeah, I think he respected a cop that was actually helpful in that way, at least, yeah. On March 9th, 1996, just a week after his initial arrest, the Sacramento Bee reported a claim from Silvera's uncle Lloyd Chapin of Stockton that Silvera admitted to him the number of his victims was 47. In part one, I mentioned an incident in which Silvera's father tried to make him beat up some kids with a baseball bat. Well, Uncle Lloyd had been present that day, goading the boy on, a bully just like the boy's father. In Oregon at the end of January 1998, Silvera took a guilty plea as part of a deal. In mid-February, he did the same in his Kansas case, and on May 20th, 1998, he pleaded guilty as a part of a bargain in Florida. Those were for the murders of William Pettit in Oregon, Charles Boyd in Kansas, and Willie Clark in Florida. After sentencing in the Oregon court, Silvera thanked Marion County District Attorney Diana Moffitt on his way out of the courtroom. He avoided the death penalty, and according to Wikipedia, is currently serving two life sentences in Wyoming Medium Correctional Institution in Torrington, Wyoming, where he serves as the head cook. The Freight Train Riders of America did away with their color-coded bandanas and conchos after Silvera's arrest. 3 years after that, a writer from the Guardian newspaper at the train yard in Spokane spotted, quote, under a nearby concrete bridge, the signature graffiti for Sidetrack, a white daubing of two tracks, a spider's web, and a crushed skull. Elvis cop detective Bill Palmini retired in 2003. His book on Silvera, co-written by Tanya Chalupa, entitled Murder on the Rails, was released the next year. Publishers Weekly deemed it long on splatter and short on insight. That's pretty accurate. The book was extremely helpful in its investigative detail, but the descriptions of the crimes and Silvera's motivations seem skewed by Silvera's version of events, so I left out anything that reads like fabrication or justification of his actions. Salem, Oregon detective Mike Quakenbush, a hero to hobos who made him a Knight of the Hobo Order of Merit in honor of his brave and relentless pursuit of Robert Silvera, said, regarding these and many other killings of transient and houseless people, quote, Quakenbush could barely hide his anger about the fate of the dispossessed and the double standards throughout America. There's a great system of justice for the rich, but forget it if you're a nobody. In July of 1996, the Associated Press reported, California and Oregon police say a search of two locations in Roseville, California this month turned up letters and notes purportedly written by Silvera and discussing killings. The letters were to a former Placer County, California jailmate who once occupied a cell next to Silvera. In one of these letters, Silvera pronounced himself the leader of his nation, that of the houseless, the drifters, and the forgotten. He declared, I could have tortured others of your world, but I chose to torture my world, because I preyed on the weak.
Wow. So in the end, he's serving life.
I believe a double life sentence. But okay. Yes, he'll be in prison forever.
And they were only able to confirm how many killings?
I believe four. I believe it was the two Oregon ones, Michael Kleitz, William Pettit, the Willie Clark in Tallahassee, Florida, and Charles Boyd in Kansas.
Okay.
Who was the one that he killed in the state park.
But outside of that, it's like, we don't really have the evidence, so it's really more of his tall tales, they presume.
I mean, I think he did a lot of them, but I also, yeah, I think maybe the random ones, there's some confabulation there. But the ones that I've covered were the ones that they were like certain that he did. And I think there are many others across the country that just couldn't be definitively tied. But
they do think he killed many people.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just so violent.
And just that constant moving.
Yeah.
Is what's really
It's amazing they were
unsettling.
Able to get him.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that uncertainty of being on the rails all the time would lead to that anger.
Mm-hmm.
It would increase your rage, I think.
Yeah.
Seeing people, you know, as you're rolling by in the train, seeing people live more of a regular life.
Right.
Probably develop a lot of hate that way, too.
Well, another one, and maybe what inspired you going down this track.
Hey.
The book that you and I have read, The Man on the Train or Man from the Train.
Yeah, that was definitely part of the reason I wanted to do this one. Yeah, The Man on the Train is one of the best.
So that's a good one for people. Since you're saying the one you did for the story isn't great, it's kind of the same idea of this serial killer who had a very specific pattern and ended up across the country, I think even in the Northwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one. Check that out by Bill James. It's awesome. Go watch Emperor of the North.
You could have been a meat eater.
Sidetrack.
You got no class.
Splash. Movie ends. Bye-bye.
I had friends that had them in baggies. They're like, oh, those are my star wrappers.
Like they're going to get
like they were going to send them in.
They still have them. Well, like, these are only appreciating.
You have to go to that Corvallis Dairy Mart. Well, look who's calling me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right, boy. Boing.
Boing, boing,
boing. Boing, boing, boing.
He dressed in a sweatshirt. Sweatshirt.
Sweatshirt.
I gotta, where's my sweatshirt?
Where's my favorite sweatshirt? I gotta wear it today. Ew, that went in my mouth.
Oh.
Ew.
The wet hanky when I breathed in. Ew. Now I gotta use this crack hanky. Interesting.
Cut that. I didn't say interesting.
Oh, yeah, right.
Fascinating. Intriguing.
That's gripping.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to use that.
Gripping. I was going to bring the
the syllabus,
thesaurus in here.
Oh, so.
And just leave it open when anyone says that. I'll be like, don't you mean?
Interesting.
Oh, don't you mean compelling?
Thrilling. Fascinating. We just need to sit and make a bunch of synonyms to record for him to pop in now.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Like edit.
So that way, whenever we say interesting, you just copy over it with one
instead
of our other
ones. Instead of a censor, it's...
Yeah.
Wow, that is so fascinating.
But we will. But we'll do it in all sorts of inflections.
Detective Quakenbush sent a
telegram. Oh, telegram.
I'm going to not do the beginning of that sentence
again. I'm going to send a telegram.
Yoshikawa was the lead. Yoshikawa was the lead.
I love it when you can beat me to it.
It's the only way I can survive. Of a wild pack.
Sorry.
Tim.
No, Tim.
Tim. No, Tim.
Not this morning. Not this time. The trains have stopped.
Oh, no. You're living
well, there was
you're
one.
The
I had
life.
Actually a derailment early this morning. And now nothing. Very early derailment.
Oh.
When you don't expect it.
Well, that's the worst.
Like the sun's not even up yet. I got to take care of this business.
I am in no state.
I was just dreaming about walking around on the floor, leaving blood everywhere.
And now we know, for future reference.
Wear a diaper on your foot?
I meant how easily blood cleaned up, but Yeah, that too.
You should see how often I almost fall over. So often. Metcalf said he believed there was a warrant out in that name.
In that name. Your name. There's a warrant in your name.
Sorry, guy. We've been looking for you.
Come with me.
Going to the slammer.
Long arm of the laws. Finally touch him.
Get into the clink. He was a bad, bad
boy.
We
got another one.
I'm so close to retirement. I'm going on glory.
He got a call. She's crazy about that little guy.
We got to get to this Elvis cop.
Ooh,
oh, yeah.
A new season of Circle is coming.
Oh,
fuck. Oh, there's
sweet.
A new season of Is It Cake? That happened to me once when I was a child. I got locked out of the house with my sister after school and I had to pee and then she convinced me to pee my pants. Have I told that story before? Boy, it worked. She was very convincing. I was like, you know what? I will do that. That's a great idea. Why take it out and pee? In our own backyard. God. Oh, it was like the story Mac told about you pretending that you had died from being from tripping over a thing that he'd put up.
Yeah.
For like 20 minutes, you lay dead on the floor while he panicked. Oh, my God.
He shouldn't have tripped me.
Yeah,
that
like,
is too funny. Yeah.
How old is he? He's like 8.
Probably.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Nice.
So funny. Dead on the floor.
Yeah, I think he was like, it was when I pushed 9-1 on the phone. You're like,
my God.
Just kidding.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderintherain.
And suck my balls.